And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's December the 16th, 350th day of the year. 15 days remain until this year's ended. On this day in 714, Pepin of Herstal, mayor of the Merovingian Palace, dies at Jupiley in modern Belgium. He's succeeded by his infant grandson, Theodoald, while his wife, Plectruda, holds actual power in the Frankish kingdom. It's said that Pepin was responsible for the assassination of the last Merovingian ruler. I'm descended from the Merovingians. 755, and Lushan revolts against Chancellor Yang Gaozong at Nanjing, initiating the An-Lushan Rebellion. That took place during the Tang Dynasty of China. 1431, Hundred Years' War. Henry VI of England is crowned King of France at Notre Dame in Paris. 1497, Vasco da Gama passes the Great Fish River at the southern tip of Africa. That's where Bartolomeu Dias previously turned back to Portugal. 1575, an earthquake with an estimated magnitude of 8.5 strikes Valdivia in Chile. Seven Years' War, Battle of Noryang. Final battle of Seven Years' War is fought between China and the Korean Allied forces and Japanese navies. That results in a decisive Allied forces victory. 1653, English Interregnum, the Protectorate. Oliver Cromwell becomes Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England. A king, but he's close. 1689, Convention Parliament. The Declaration of Rights is embodied in the Bill of Rights. 1761, Seven Years' War. After 4 months' siege, the Russians under Pyotr Rumyantsev take the Prussian fortress of Kolobrzeg. 1773, American Revolution. The Boston Tea Party took place on this date. Members of the Sons of Liberty, disguised as Mohawk Indians, dump hundreds of crates of tea into Boston Harbor as a protest against the Tea Act. So if you feel like celebrating, run down and dump tea in your local harbor. 1777, Virginia becomes the first state to ratify the Articles of Confederation. That was the predecessor to the Constitution. 1782, British East India Company, Bharam Rebellion, Hadda and Mada Mia lead the first anti-British uprising in the subcontinent against the Robert Lindsay and his contingents in Sayyid Shahi Idag. 1811, the first two in a series of four severe earthquakes occur in the vicinity of New Madrid, Missouri. In fact, one of the largest earthquakes in history took place in New Madrid. 1826, Benjamin Edwards rides into Mexican-controlled Nagadosis, Texas, declares himself ruler of the Republic of Fredonia. 1838, the Great Trek, Battle of Blood River. Troop trekkers led by Andres Pretorius and Sorrel Chillers defeat Zulu impis led by Dambuza and Nadella Kasamski in what's today KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. 1843, the discovery of Octonians by John Graves, who denoted them with a bold-faced O, was announced to his mathematician friend William Hamilton. He discovered the quaternions in a letter on this particular date. 1850, the Charlotte Jane and the Randolph bring the first of the Canterbury Pilgrims to Lyttelton, New Zealand. And there went the neighborhood. 1863, American Civil War. Joseph Johnston replaces Braxton Bragg as commander of the Confederate Army of Tennessee. 1864, American Civil War, Battle of Nashville. Union's Army of the Cumberland routs and utterly destroys the Confederacy's Army of the Tennessee, ending its effectiveness as a combat unit. 1880, outbreak of the First Boer War between Boer South African Republic and British Empire took place on this date. 1882, Wales and England contest the first Home Nations rugby union match. It's now the Six Nations match. 1883, the Tonkin Campaign. French forces captured the Santé Citadel. 1903, the Taj Mahal Palace and Tower Hotel in Bombay opens its doors to guests on this date. 1905, in rugby union, the match of the century is played between Wales and New Zealand at Cardiff Arms Park. 1907, the American Great White Fleet began its circumnavigation of the world. It was a meet and greet expedition. 1912, First Balkan War. The Royal Hellenic Navy defeats the Ottoman Navy at the Battle of Ely. 1914, World War I. Admiral Franz von Hipper commands a raid on Scarborough, Hartlepool, and Whitby. 1918, Vincas Mikovicius Kapsoukas declares the formation of the Lithuanian Soviet Socialist Republic. It dissolves in 1919. 1920, the Haiyuan earthquake of 8.5 rocks the Gansu province in China. It's estimated it killed over 200,000 people. 1922, President of Poland, Gabriel Narutowicz, assassinated by Leszek Ludowicki at the Zata Gallery in Warsaw. 1930, bank robber Herbert Lamb and members of his crew were killed by a 200-strong posse following a botched bank robbery in Clinton, Indiana. You know you have a bad day as a bank robber when you got 200 folks chasing you. 1937, Theodore Cole and Ralph Rowe attempted to escape from the American federal prison on Alcatraz in San Francisco. Neither's ever seen again. 1938, Adolf Hitler institutes the Cross of Honor of the German Mother. 1942, the Holocaust. Schutzstaffel Chief Heinrich Himmler orders that Roma candidates for extermination be deported to Auschwitz. Schutzstaffel was what we know as the SS. 1944, World War II, the Battle of the Bulge begins with a surprise offensive of three German armies through the Ardennes Forest. Had they had fuel, they would probably have won, and the war would probably still be going on. 1947, William Shockley, John Barton, and Walter Brattain build the first practical point contact transistor. 1950, Korean War. In response to China's second phase offensive, President Truman declares a limited state of emergency. 1960, United Airlines Douglas DC-8 and TWA Lockheed Super Constellation collide over Staten Island, New York. And crash, of course. Kill all 128 on board both aircraft and six more people on the ground. You know you're having a bad day when a plane falls on you. 1965, Vietnam War. General William Westmoreland sends Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara a request for 243,000 more men by the end of 1966. 1968, Second Vatican Council, official revocation of the Edict of Expulsion of Jews from Spain took place on this date. 1971, Bangladesh Liberation War and Indo-Pakistani War of 1971. Ceasefire of the Pakistan Army brings an end to both conflicts. This is commemorated annually as Victory Day in Bangladesh and as Vijay Diwas in India. 1971, the UK recognizes Bahrain's independence, which is commemorated annually as Bahrain's National Day. This day in 1978, in Cleveland, Ohio, it becomes the first major American city to default on its financial obligations since the Great Depression. 1979, Libya joins four of the OPEC nations in raising crude oil prices and has an immediate dramatic effect on the United States, even though it takes a while for the price increase to make its way down the chain. Oil companies immediately jump on them. 1985, Paul Castellano and Thomas Bilotti are shot dead on the orders of John Gotti. He assumes leadership in New York's Gambino crime family. 1989, Romanian Revolution. Protests break out in Timișoara, Romania, in response to an attempt by the government to evict dissident Hungarian pastor Laszlo Tokas. 1989, U.S. Appeals Court Judge Robert Smith Vance is assassinated by a mail bomb sent by Walter Leroy Moody, Jr. 1991, Kazakhstan declares independence from the Soviet Union. 2013, a bus falls from an elevated highway in the Philippines' capital of Manila. Kills at least 18 with 20 others injured. 2014, Tariq Taliban, Pakistan militants attack an army public school in Peshawar, Pakistan. 150 are killed, 132 of them are children. And those are the Taliban that apparently our president worships. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day, Adelaide of Italy. Haggai, Ralph Adams Cram, Richard Upjohn, and John LaFarge in the Episcopal Church in the U.S. Day of Reconciliation, formerly celebrated as Day of the Vow by the Afrikaners in South Africa. National Day celebrates withdrawal of the United Kingdom, withdrawal of the U.K. from Bahrain, which made Bahrain an independent emirate in 1971. In Thailand, it's National Sports Day. It's the beginning of the 9-day celebration, beginning December 16th and ending December 24th, celebrating the trials which Mary and Joseph endured before finding a place to stay where Jesus could be born and Hispana died. First day of Las Posadas in Mexico and Latin America. First day of the Simbang Gabe Novena of Masses in the Philippines. In Bangladesh, it's Victory Day. And in India, it is also considered Victory Day. Well, let's see what else we've got. In 882, Marinus I begins his reign as Catholic Pope. He succeeds John VIII. 1392, Nanboku Cho, Emperor Go Kamayama of Japan, abdicates in favor of rival claimant Go Kamamatsu. 1497, Portuguese navigator Vasco de Gama is the first European to sail along Africa's east coast. He names it Natal. 1538, King Francois I orders renewed pursuit of Protestants. Got to get rid of those Protestants, don't you know? 1577, Danzig surrenders to troops of the Polish king István Báthory. One of his relatives was the Blood Countess. 1617, Spanish Viceroy Hernando Arias de Saavedra founds the provinces Rio de la Plata in Argentina and Guare in Paraguay. 1631, Mount Vesuvius in Italy erupts, buries a lot of villages under lava flows, kills over 3,000 people. 1659, General Monk demands free parliamentary elections in Scotland. 1689, English Parliament passes the Bill of Rights, establishing limits on crown powers and the requirement for regular elections. On this day in 1707 is the last recorded eruption of Mount Fuji in Japan. 1775, Englishman Richard Arkwright gets a patent for his carding machine for use in cotton mills. 1817, leaders of the Moluccas uprising are hung in Ambon. 1835, a fire in New York City burns over 600 buildings. 1857, it was a major earthquake in Naples, Italy. 1864, the battle in Nashville ends after 4,400 casualties are incurred on both sides. 1884, Great Britain recognizes King Leopold II's Congo Free State. 1890, the Negro Methodist Episcopal Church is founded in Jackson, Tennessee. 1897, on this date, the first submarine with an internal combustion engine is demonstrated. 1900, the Boer Army under General Kritzinger takes the Cape Colony. 1901, Boer General Kritzinger is captured. On this day in 1905, Variety, which covers all phases of show business, is first published. 1907, Eugenia Farrar is the first to sing over a wireless radio broadcast. Took place at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. 1908, the first credit union in the U.S. is formed in Manchester, New Hampshire. 1909, a conservative revolution and U.S. pressure forces Nicaraguan President Jose Santos to leave office. 1912, the first U.S. postage stamp picturing an airplane, a 20-cent parcel post stamp, was issued. 1912, the first Balkan War, the Ottoman Navy is defeated by the Royal Hellenic Navy. 1913, comedian, actor, and filmmaker Charlie Chaplin begins his film career at Keystone for $150 a week. 1914, a French offensive in Artois, northern France, is led by Philippe Pétain. 1918, German troops evacuate Finland, give over Kiev and Ukraine to revolutionary forces, and pull back from Estonia as Bolshevik forces move in. 1921, the Communist Party of South Africa calls for a united front and a pass-burning campaign on Dingaan's Day. 1922, the Mutual Association of Eastern Colored Baseball Clubs formally organizes on this date. 1924, archaeologist and explorer Hiram Bingham is elected as a Republican to serve in the U.S. Senate, which forces him to resign as governor of Connecticut after serving only one day in office. That is the shortest term of any Connecticut governor. 1930, golfer Bobby Jones is the first to win the James Sullivan Award. That's the best U.S. amateur athlete. 1940, on this date, there's a British air raid on Mannheim. 1941, Sarawak is occupied by the Japanese. 1942, on this date, Hitler orders combat against partisans in Russia and Balkans. 1944, the German V-2 strikes Antwerp Bioscope. 638 are killed. 1944, U.S. 2nd Infantry Division occupies Heartbreak Crossroads, Wallershead. 1946, French fashion designer Christian Dior and his backer Marcel Boussac found the fashion house Christian Dior. 1946, Thailand joins United Nations. 1949, Savinska Aeroplan. Aktiebolaget, known as Saab, is founded in Sweden. 1950, Shirley Temple announces her retirement from films at the advanced age of 22. 1951, NBC premieres Dragnet. 1959, snow falling in Lower Rai Pass in West Pakistan kills 48. 1961, Martin Luther King Jr. joins over 500 jailed demonstrators who'd been arrested in Albany, Georgia. 1965, on this date, Gemini 6 returns to Earth. That same year, Pioneer 6 is launched into solar orbit. 1969, Hello Dolly, which starred Barbara, I'm Just the Greatest in the World, Streisand premieres. 1969, the British House of Commons votes 343 to 185 to abolish the death penalty. 1972, the Bangladesh Constitution goes into effect. 1975, the first broadcast of the TV series One Day at a Time took place on CBS. 1976, Andrew Young named ambassador and chief U.S. delegate to the UN. 1976, after we were taken at gunpoint to get our vaccinations, the government halts planned flu vaccination program, following reports that certain people were paralyzed after getting the vaccination. I was teaching at the infantry school. No. I was a student at the infantry school when I was taken at gunpoint to get the vaccination. 1978, Ronald Reagan announces President Jimmy, I'm King, Carter's recognition of the People's Republic of China. 1980, President-elect Ronald Reagan announces Alexander Haig as the 59th Secretary of State. And every time a car backfired in Washington, I saw Haig vaulting hedges heading for the White House to declare himself president. 1983, the spokesperson for The Who announces the group is disbanding. 1987, Roh Tae-woo elected president of South Korea. And in 1990, Reverend John Bertrand Aristide elected president of Haiti. And a sad day in 1993, Shannon Doherty is fired from the TV series Beverly Hills 90210. Well, with all that said and done, let's go talk about things that are strange. There's enough of it in this country right now. You know, sometimes when people make strange pronouncements, we just discount them out of hand because they don't make any sense. But in this particular instance, time after time, something sank its fangs into the screaming girl, even while the police held her. Now, what was biting her, nobody knew, but there was no doubt in anybody's mind after seeing the fang marks that something was biting her. The night was May 10th, 1951. Been warm and quiet in Manila till the police brought that hysterical girl into the headquarters. Chief Medical Examiner slammed his hat on his head and snorted, "It's total nonsense. You get me out of bed in the middle of the night to look at a girl who has epileptic fits." The mayor of Manila, who was present, said nothing. He looked in bewilderment at the irate doctor and at the screaming girl. There were the welts on her arms, the teeth marks. Of course, the doctor said she had bit herself while in the throes of an epileptic seizure. But it looked for all the world as they'd been savagely driven into her flesh, as she'd claimed, by something or somebody that had attacked her in a locked jail cell. Now, Mayor Arsenio Laxon didn't know, but the case was sustained. Chief Police had been called. He, in turn, had called the medical examiner. And together, they'd gone to the jail to examine the cause of all the excitement. An 18-year-old by the name of Clarita Villanueva. It was decided she was just another of the countless homeless youngsters the war had left adrift in the streets of Manila. When police found her, she was the center of a small crowd on a street corner screaming that she was being attacked and bitten. The onlookers, most of them considered scum from nearby taverns, were cheering her on and winking knowingly at each other. And they all made signs indicating that, in their opinion, the girl was insane. Maybe she was on dope or absinthe. Whatever it was, the police left others to determine. They just grabbed her and took her to jail. Well, as the door clanged shut behind her, she fell sobbing to the floor. Police ignored her request. They looked at the 8 sets of teeth marks where she said the thing had bitten her. Now, she called it the thing, but their question was, what thing? Clarita could only describe it as a thing that looked like a man, except he had big bulging eyes and wearing a loose black cape, and he seemed to float in the air when he wanted to. And then she began to scream, shrieking the thing was coming. It was coming through the bars. Well, the exasperated police unlocked the cell door and led her into the hall, still screaming at the top of her voice. And right in front of their eyes, more teeth marks appeared on her upper arms and shoulders. Marks that were surrounded by what appeared to be saliva. So the senior officer ran for his captain, and the captain, after he looked at it, called the chief. And after the medical examiner came and snorted and left, the mayor and the chief of police examined the marks on the girl for themselves. Were they self-inflicted? Well, they told each other that was not possible. You can't bite yourself on the back of the neck or on the back of the shoulders where this girl been bitten. So clearly something strange was going on. Well, Clarita Villanueva spent the rest of the night on a bench in the front office of the Manila Police Station where she finally sobbed herself to sleep. Next morning, as the police prepared to take her into court to face vagrancy charges, she began to scream again. She said the thing was back and biting her. Two strong policemen grabbed her, one holding each hand, and before their astounded eyes and those of reporters and the medical examiner himself, teeth marks appeared, sunk deeply into her arms, the palms of her hands, and her neck. Now, this attack lasted for at least 5 minutes before the girl fainted and sank to the floor. Medical examiner Mariana Lara examined her again and then reversed herself. She said the girl was not having an epileptic seizure at all. The bite marks were real and not self-inflicted. He asked that the mayor be called at once, and the archbishop as well. It was some 30 minutes before the mayor got there, and by that time Clarita had regained consciousness. The bites on her arm were badly swollen, and the palm of one hand was thick and bruised where the teeth prints had been deeply embedded. Well, as the mayor and the medical examiner went with her to the prison hospital, Clarita began shrieking. The thing was after her again. And this time she said he had a helper, another bug-eyed creature. Well, Mayor Laxon later testified that as he watched, livid teeth marks appeared on the opposite sides of her throat, on her index finger. And one set of teeth prints was deeply embedded in the girl's hand, even while the mayor held it. Well, the 15 minutes at the prison hospital was a nightmare for the mayor, the medical examiner, the girl, and even the driver of the automobile. But once they got there, the attack stopped, and Chloe began her slow recovery. Never again underwent such an experience. According to Mayor Laxon, there is something here that defies explanation. According to the medical examiner, Dr. Mariana Lara, I was just scared stiff. Well, every year, thousands and thousands of people vanish for no explanation whatsoever. And that's bad enough, but what happens when groups disappear? How about the steamboat that sailed around the bend to oblivion in broad daylight? Or how about the army that marched down the road and vanished without a trace? Where did they go? Well, the last stevedore had shuffled across the long gangplank to the riverbank. The cargo of cotton and molasses was all on board the steamboat. Two long blasts of her steam trumpet to warn small boats to get out of the way, and the Iron Mountain belched fire and smoke as she shoved off from Vicksburg that bright June morning in 1872. A few minutes later, she went around the bend, pulling a line of barges bound for Louisville with 400 bales of cotton. And after Louisville, she was going to Cincinnati and finally Pittsburgh, which was her destination. Well, we'll never know what happened to that steamboat after she vanished from sight around the bend. Whatever her fate was, it came swiftly and, we hope, mercifully. First inkling something gone wrong came a couple of hours later when another sternwheeler, the Iroquois chief, had to churn the river full emergency power to get out of the way of a string of runaway barges. Well, these things happened occasionally when tow lines broke, so the other corps chief observed the customary amenities. It chased the barges, overtook them, and stood by to await the return of the Iron Mountain. Well, while they waited, the crewman on the Iroquois chief noticed a very peculiar thing. The tow rope on the barges had not broken as they first thought. It had been cut cleanly, a move that was taken only in emergencies when a steamboat was fighting for its very life. Well, they waited and waited and waited. Unfortunately, the Iron Mountain was never seen again. If it had burned, it would have been seen by other passing craft, and debris would have been found on the water's surface. If it had been snagged and sunk, the barrels of molasses and the cotton bale stacked on the deck would have littered the river for miles. And if the boilers had blown up, the evidence would have been unmistakable. But as it was, there was nothing. The Iron Mountain was a massive riverboat, 180 feet long, 35 feet wide. Took her cargo and 55 passengers and crew around the bend into oblivion. It was never seen again. Let's go to December 14, 1928. The Danish training ship Copenhagen, preparing to leave the harbor of Montevideo. She awaited only the arrival of the 50 cadets who were taking part in a ceremony at the Danish consulate. It was to be their last cruise on a training vessel. When they got back to Denmark, they'd been enrolled as full-fledged seamen. Future looked bright for those young men. But unfortunately, the truth was something entirely different. For them, the future consisted of only a few more hours. Shortly before noon, the cadets came swinging aboard the Copenhagen, singing as they marched down the gangplank. Ship steamed slowly out of the harbor, went past a couple of small fishing vessels, and vanished. Incoming ships we should have sighted or saw neither the vessel nor any trace of her, with any wreckage floating on the sea surface. The Copenhagen, like the Iron Mountain before, sailed into oblivion. Well, history records several cases of entire armies vanishing, including 4,000 trained, fully equipped troops who camped one night beside a small stream in the Pyrenees during the Spanish War of Succession. Next morning, they had a rendezvous with destiny. They broke camp, formed ranks, marched into the foothills, and vanished from the sight of their fellow men. There's been no sign of them to this day. It was a fate they shared with 650 French colonial troops who were marching towards Saigon and Indochina in 1858. Marching along the highway across open country only 15 miles outside the city, they vanished as completely as if they'd walked off the earth. Modern official military documents record the bare details of a mystery fully as baffling as those we've covered. The Japanese sacking Nanking on December 10th, 1939 in central China gave rise to another mystery. Central China at that point was a supine giant, helpless before the ravaging aggressors. It was imperative the Japanese be delayed as long as possible. Every hour counted to the beleaguered Chinese forces. To this end, Colonel Li Puxin stationed his troops across an area in the rolling country south of Nanking. 2 hours later, his aides reported the troops didn't respond to radio signals. When investigators arrived, they found the guns stacked beside their little cooking fires, but all the troops were gone. They couldn't have deserted across the open country without being detected. Japanese records reveal no trace of them as possible prisoners of war. There wasn't even a record of any encounters between the Japanese and these troops. But not one of the 2,988 missing men has ever been seen or heard from since that fateful day. But if you want to talk about one of the strangest cases on record, let's talk about the twin-engine marine plane with 32 people on board that crashed on Tahoma Glacier in 1947. 2 days later, searchers reached the plane. There was evidence nobody had survived the head-on crash, but how about the remains of the 32 men on board? A reward of $5,000 was offered for the discovery of the bodies, and that was a considerable amount of money in 1947, but not one single body has ever been found. Well, we've all heard stories about police using psychics. But how about when the federal government calls in ghosts to help solve a crime? The most notorious crime of the century was the Lindbergh kidnapping. Baffled authorities actually called in spiritualists with surprising results. The story began sometime on the early evening of March 1st, 1932. That's when a fiend in human form committed the most widely publicized crime of the 20th century. Parked his car in a small clearing off the narrow gravel road that led through the heavily wooded countryside at the home of Colonel Charles Lindbergh. That was a few miles from Hopewell, New Jersey. From the back seat of the car, the kidnapper took a sectional ladder that he carried to the hedge that rimmed the Lindbergh lawn. There he put the ladder together, carried it to the side of the house, and put it beside the window of the room in which the 20-month-old baby boy was sleeping. It was only a few minutes later that he carried the child down the ladder, which broke. Kidnapper and victim fell to the earth. You could still find signs of the mishap. Police reported it when they got there the next day. Well, the hue and cry that followed the kidnapping of Charles Lindbergh Jr. amounted to a worldwide indignation. It brought into the news an assortment of unusual characters who contributed little to the case except delay. For example, there was the confused businessman from Norfolk, Virginia, who claimed he'd been contacted by the kidnappers. Days were wasted before the falsity of his claims became apparent. Then there was a note from the kidnapper that led the authorities on a fruitless search for a boat on which the child was supposedly being held. The note was genuine, but the boat was non-existent. Among the oddballs, there was an eccentric retired schoolteacher in the Bronx who placed an advertisement in a neighborhood paper, which by some improbable chance happened to be the one paper the kidnapper actually read. Ransom money was paid in gold certificates, a type of money subsequently withdrawn from circulation by the government. They did that so that when the kidnapper spent the money, the trail would lead right back to him. Eventually, these bills led to the capture of a German war veteran named Bruno Hauptmann. He lived quietly with his wife and son in a modest house near Bronx. Unemployed, he still had plenty of spending money. Most of it appeared to be the ransom money from the kidnapping. And by entangling him and tightly in a web of circumstantial evidence, the government led Hoffman to the electric chair. But there were some strange aspects to this case that were never explained. It is a matter of record Hoffman had at least two accomplices, a man and a woman. But they were never found, and no effort was made to find them after he was captured. It's also a matter of record that part of the Lindbergh ransom money was never recovered, although it is true Hoffman had most of it. Readily apparent that the kidnapper had known the movements of those inside the house the night the child was carried away, which may explain the suicide of Betty Gow, the baby's red-headed nurse. At the height of the search for the missing baby, when there was still hope he'd be found alive, officers on the case were desperate. They were swarming around the Lindbergh home, waiting for some break in the case, anything that might help them solve it. Then the phone rang. A call came from a man who identified himself as a Brooklyn minister. He told him one of his parishioners had information concerning the case, information that couldn't be revealed till they were on the scene of the kidnapping. Well, the Secret Service sent officers to meet the man and his companion at Hopewell the next morning. He identified himself as a minister of a spiritualist church. The woman with him, he said, was a trance medium who would try to establish contact with the missing child if she could be put in the room where he had been kidnapped for an hour or so. Well, the annoyed Secret Service agents didn't take her to the Lindbergh home because of the highly disturbed condition of the expectant Mrs. Lindbergh. So they took her to the nearest house and to a room facing the same direction as that from which the baby had been abducted. And the woman went into a deep trance, and for the next 2.5 hours, she told the two Secret Service agents and a stenographer the baby was in an unpainted house 4.5 miles northeast of where they sat, and the kidnapper would kill the baby if searching parties approach, because they were watching the Lindbergh house through binoculars. Well, when the body of the Lindbergh baby was found May 12th, about 3 weeks after that weird seance took place, it was found about 4.5 miles northeast of the Lindbergh home, a few hundred yards from an unpainted shack. The shack bore evidence that a baby had recently been there and a red-headed woman, and that they had left hurriedly, as the medium had described. And although the Secret Service ignored the results of the seance, subsequent events showed that the medium's statements had tallied closely with the facts. A set of circumstances that defies explanation by conventional science. Unfortunately, what appears to have been the Lindbergh baby was dead. Though there have been a number of folks who claim to actually be the Lindbergh baby, but their claims have never been confirmed. Well, speaking of mediums, Scotland Yard came up against a blank wall time after time in its search for the missing stone of Scone. It turned reluctantly to the one man who might be able to help him. His name was Peter Hercose, said to be the man with the X-ray mind. Now, the Stone of Scone had been stolen right out of Westminster Abbey in December 1950. That crime made headlines all over the world, made a laughingstock of the London police. Peter Hercose, a quite unassuming young Dutchman, met with the Scotland Yard representatives in Dordrecht to discuss terms. Together, he and a detective flew to London, where other officials and a police sergeant met him at the airport and rushed him to the scene of that sensational robbery. There in the famed old abbey, the authorities let him handle a tool abandoned by the thieves in the restaurants lost by one of them. Hours of study of the scene and of the food scraps left by the thieves, Hercose slowly traced on a map of the city of London the path that he said had been taken by the burglars as a haul away the stone. Though he had never seen London before, he described in detail the buildings along the route he traced and described the thieves, three men and a woman, in detail. And when they were finally captured 3 months later, they were found to tally with the descriptions Hercose had given. Now, during the war, Hercose had worked closely with the underground. When Dutch patriots became suspicious of a new member, they brought the man's picture to Hercose. He ran his fingers over it for a few minutes and said, "I see this man in the uniform of a German officer." He was subsequently watched, detected in the act of transmitting information to the Germans, confessed to being an officer in the Nazi counter-espionage service, just as Hercose had said he was. Well, the police in Nijmegen and Holland had a good reason to be grateful to Hercos. In August of 1951, the old Dutch city and the surrounding countryside was plagued with fires, unquestionably the work of one or more firebugs. More than 200 armed men patrolled the area, but the fires continued to devour barns and houses and bridges. One night, several weeks after the rash of fires began, Hercos was walking with an old friend, a textile manufacturer in Nijmegen. Suddenly, Hercos stopped and told his friend another fire is going to break out, this one at the farm of a family named Jansen. Together, the two friends hurried to warn the police, only to learn the fire had been reported a few minutes before they got to the station. Well, for their part, the police weren't just skeptical, they were rude, but Hercos insisted he could help him if he gave him a chance. Closing his eyes, he described the contents of the police captain's pockets, even to the partially obliterated brand name on a pencil stub. Well, at that point, it was decided what they have to lose, so Hercos got his chance, and the police of Nijmegen got their firebug. First, Hercos asked to be taken to the scene of several of the fires. Groping through the ashes, he finally came up with a charred screwdriver handle. Felt it silently for a moment, said I have to look for a boy in his teens. Shown a school yearbook picture of every schoolboy in town, Hercos finally pointed to one in a group and said, "This, that one, that's the one I want to talk to." He named the 17-year-old son one of the richest men in town. Police captain snorted and said, "Ridiculous." But Hercos kept right on talking. "In that boy's pockets," he said, "you'll find a box of matches, a bottle of lighter fluid in the other, but this boy doesn't smoke." When brought to the station, the boy, of course, denied everything, though Hercos said, "Pull up the left leg of your overalls and show the police the scratches you got from the barbed wires you ran from the fire." Well, the scratches were on his leg, and at that point, the boy broke down and confessed. He was sent to a mental institution. That astounding solution made headlines, of course, but to Hercos, it was merely routine. Taken to the scene of a murder where a man had been shot to death on his own doorstep, Hercos rubbed the victim's coat for a moment and told police the killer had been an older man with spectacles, a mustache, and a wooden leg, and had tossed the murder weapon on the roof of the house. Well, police searched, found the gun, and the fingerprints convicted the victim's father-in-law, who had a mustache, thick glasses, and a wooden leg. Well, even Hercos himself doesn't know how he arrives at the answers, but in 1958 he's brought to the U.S. to be studied by a group of mental specialists. And they also had to admit that they were baffled by Hercos, the man with the radar brain, whose gift, whatever it might be, is indeed much stranger than science. Well, when people are facing death, quite often they sit down and write out instructions for the disposal of their estates. And since they're written by all sorts of people under all sorts of circumstances, small wonder the law is forced to deal with some very strange legacies. Now, some of the oldest wills on record date back 2,000 years or more, and were almost without exception documents intended to prevent bloodshed among the heirs of the people who made the wills. Aristotle's will, written in 322 B.C., was very scholarly, of course. He appointed friends as executors, named a proper guardian for his daughter, freed his female slaves, and included directions for his burial. American Revolutionary War statesman, Gouverneur Morris, was a generous man who willed half his sizable fortune to his widow, with the provision she should receive the entire estate if she married again. But Patrick Henry, the often quoted firebrand legislature, didn't share Mr. Morris's views. He ruled his widow should have his estate only in case she remained single. Otherwise, she'd get nothing. He explained his views to a friend by saying, "It would make me unhappy to feel that I've worked all my life only to support another man's wife. And as I tell my wife, when you've had the best, why look at the rest?" The will of Edgar Bergen gives evidence of his sentimental attachment for dummy Charlie McCarthy. Bergen bequeathed $10,000 to the Actors Fund of America with the provision the directors of the organization keep Charlie in good and serviceable condition. At least $500 of the bequest is to be used each year to entertain children in orphanages and hospitals and other institutions. At those events, Charlie McCarthy is to be one of the featured performers. How about Louis Pasteur, the famed French bacteriologist? He left a will that was typical of this man. He said, "This is my testament. I leave to my wife all the law permits a man to leave. May my children never be able to stray away from the track of duty and keep always for their mother the tenderness which she deserves." 1934, Bottle was picked up on the shores of South Africa by a couple prospectors and found it buried in the sands. Bottle contained a piece of parchment signed by one Felipe Chagrandes, who identified himself as a castaway on an island somewhere near the equator and west of Africa. He told how he and five others from his ship, the Santa Cecile, had reached the island after their vessel had been demolished by a storm. He wrote that all his companions were dead and he felt his own time was short, so he laboriously penned in his own blood instructions for dividing his estate in Lisbon among his relatives. Well, the message was forwarded to Spanish authorities in Lisbon, but it was unlikely they could carry out the instructions because that will had been in that bottle 178 years at the time it was found. Now, women also, it seems, make wills. One Bridget Phillison of Bournemouth left a will in 1938 when she divided her estate between her sister and her husband. She wrote the sister was to deliver the husband's portion of the estate in person by taking it to the nearest pub while he'll be found drinking in my absence. Wills oftentimes have to be written in haste and under most unusual circumstances, such as the case of the Wyoming rancher who vanished on an automobile trip through the mountains. When his car was found 21 days later, his body was pinned in the wreckage at the bottom of a canyon. He lived 5 days in that particular condition and realized he wasn't going to survive, so he had taken his car keys and scratched out a brief will on the dashboard of the car. And the court accepted that document as valid. George Washington, a very methodical man, left a will that covered 25 pages of foolscap. Named his wife and six other people as executors, and he explained that with seven people on the list, there would surely be somebody who could carry out the provisions, and he was certainly right. About what Robert Louis Stevenson bequeathed his birthday to a friend who complained to her own fellow on Christmas Day. P.T. Barnum had his will printed into a 55-page pamphlet that provided detailed instructions for distributing his fortune and for the maintenance of his circus and his beloved freaks, many of whom couldn't care for themselves. Rabelais, the Frenchman, his will was very short and to the point. He said, "I have nothing, I owe much, all the rest I give to the poor." Well, Francis Lord of Sydney, Australia, left to his widow 1 shilling. To be used for tram fare so she can go someplace and drown herself. But maybe the strangest of all was the last will and testament of a wealthy, eccentric woman who lived in Cherokee County, North Carolina. She willed her estate to God. So the court dutifully issued a summons, and the sheriff went through the motions of trying to serve it. Finally, he filed his report with the court, and it said, "After due diligence and a diligent search, God cannot be found in Cherokee County." And certainly that could well be the case. Let's talk about a young man named Tom Fuller. He was an illiterate 70-year-old slave, but he had the ability to outperform even UNIVAC. He'd been born in Africa, captured by slave traders, sold into bondage in Virginia. Until he was 70 years old, there was little reason to regard him as anything more than a run-of-the-mill slave. He was standing in a fence corner of his master's Virginia plantation one hot afternoon in August of 1799, waiting for the overseer to assign him another task. He was just one of a little group of 7 ragged slaves who stood patiently and quietly while the overseer and the owner of the plantation fumbled with the problem in math. How much was the crop on that farm worth at current tobacco prices? The owner came up with one answer. The overseer had another, and both were stubborn men, and both were poor hands at simple arithmetic. They figured, they argued, tempers beginning to flare when the owner threw down his pencil and paper with a curse. Old Tom removed his floppy hat at that point and stepped forward, and he said, "Please, sir, I can tell you the answer to that figuring." Well, the surprised owner invited Tom to give him the answer if he could, and Tom promptly provided a figure that later proved to be correct. It also proved both the plantation owner and the overseer had been wrong in their calculations. A school teacher who confirmed Tom's solution went to the plantation to put the illiterate slave to the test and came away more mystified than ever, because old Tom heard the problems and furnished the answers in a flash. One of the problems that the teacher had worked out in advance of the rest called for the old man to reduce 70 years, set 12 days and 12 hours to seconds. Well, it took him 90 seconds to give the correct answer. School teacher and the plantation owner shook their heads, sorry, but the old man's answer didn't match their own. Later, when they rechecked the calculations, they discovered his figure was the correct one. His examiners failed to take into consideration the leap years involved. Tom didn't make that mistake. He became a sensation, and his proud owner refused many tempting offers to sell him to promoters who wanted to exploit him. He permitted scholars to come and put him to the test. Without exception, they came away with the answers to their problems, without an answer as to how the old man functioned as a human calculating machine. Well, as late as 1915, another man whose strange powers baffled science was Charles Chancellor of Knoxville. He was a member of the bar and also principal of Austin, a Negro high school in Knoxville. In 1915, he was touring the country giving demonstrations of his remarkable abilities. He would carry in his head figures involving many millions, could instantly give the square of these figures, generally beating the best existing calculating machines by sizable margins. One of his most effective exhibitions was that of what is customarily open his performances. Heavily blindfolded with his back to the blackboard, spectators could write long columns of figures on the board. An incanceler would remove the blindfold, walk to the blackboard, instantly write the correct total of the figures on the board. In 3 or 4 seconds required for him to cross the stage, his mind computed the total. His high-level general intelligence was in marked contrast to the mental quality which characterized many of these human calculators. Jedediah Buxton was illiterate. Born in England in 1907, he had no schooling at all. But for unknown reason, he was always fascinated by numbers and, in fact, was unable to sconce out on anything else. As a child, he mentally calculated the number of lentils in his soup, the grains of salt in a cellar of a given size. In church, he sat quietly through the services, but when they were over, he could recall nothing except the number of words in the sermon. To run a field, he could tell how many square inches it contained. Once, for his own amusement, he calculated how much a farthing would be worth if it were doubled 139 times. Pound sterling, the answer required a 39-digit number. Buxton was asked to multiply this fantastic sum by itself, and 2.5 months later, he produced the correct answer, explaining he had worked on it at intervals during that time. An oddity of his performance was that once he started on a complicated problem, he could forget it and pursue his normal activities as though his brain was some sort of machine that carried on the complex function unassisted once it began. Now, there have been many of these astounding cases, none of which is explainable by conventional science. They constitute a natural grant of extraordinary mental powers, and they also constitute another well-documented mystery located in that no-man's land of the human mind. There are many, many... Well, I've always said the mind is unbelievably powerful, and there are many, many mysteries that we'll never have the answers to. And on that note, we've run out of time. We'll be back tomorrow, and once again, we'll talk about Tales of the Unexplained. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.